You're part of the thing you bought, you know? Part of a book is as good as a whole book, right? No, no more. There's a few pages missing, so what? Want your money back? Okay. If, however, among some, it is not known about the predicate and the subject, what it is, the statement in itself is evident, right? But not among those who ignore the what? Subject, or ignorant of the subject and the predicate of the statement, right? So I say to my students, I know they don't know what a perfect number is, huh? So it's obvious to me, I said, that a perfect number is a composite number. It isn't to you. It's obvious to me. What's wrong with you guys? Well, if you know what a perfect number is, huh? It's a number, what? Equal to the sum of everything that measures it. Measures in a strict sense, evenly. Mm-hmm. So 4 is not a perfect number. It's measured by 1 and 2, but not by 3, and 1 and 2 don't add to 4. Mm-hmm. But 6 is the first perfect number. It's measured by 1 and by 2 and by 3, but not by 4 or by 5. And 1 plus 2 plus 3 adds up to 6, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, now, a prime number is measured only by 1. So obviously, no prime number could be a what? A perfect number. So it's obvious to me that a perfect number is a composite number, but it's not to my students, because they have not the slightest notion what a perfect number is. You see? Okay. So that's some of the distinction that the great Boethius gives, right? That there are some statements that are known to themselves by all men, because all men know their parts, their subject and predicate, like whole and part. Others are known only to the what? The wise. Not necessarily wise in the fullest sense, but those who have some education, right? That's the soft part, huh? Okay. That some common thoughts of the soul, that there are some thoughts they call the common thoughts of the soul, empiriously known. Apud sapientis only, among the wise only, as bodiless things are not in place, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So this to be when I was in grade school, where's God? You know? Okay. So where's heaven? Well, the answer was wherever God is. Where they're thinking, you know, spatially of these things. It's like, you know, when the communists, you know, were still in full power there in Russia, you know, and they said, that's not there. And he's radiating back, you know, there's no God up here, you know. Kind of even taste sometimes of totalitarians. Kind of funny. I say, therefore, that this statement, God is, in itself is what? Per se known, right? Because the predicate is the same with the subject. He is I am who am, right? God is his own existence, his own to be, as will be clear later on in the question on the simplicity of God. But because we do not know about God what he is, right? He is not known to us, per se, huh? But needs to be demonstrated to those things which are more known towards us, right? And less known towards nature, namely through what? Effects, huh? Okay. That goes back to the thing that Aristotle taught in the second book of wisdom, right? What's more known to us is less known by nature. Less known simply. Okay. No, it goes back to reply to the first objection here. To the first, therefore, it should be said that to know God to be in something common under a certain confusion is naturally inserted in us, huh? Insofar as God is the beatitude of what?
Yeah.
Man, huh? For man naturally desires beatitude. And what is naturally desired by man is naturally known by him. But this is not to know simply and without qualification that God is, right? Just as to know the one coming is not to know Peter, although Peter is what? Coming. For many think that the perfect good of man, which is beatitude, they estimate to be what? Wealth, right? Others what? Pleasures, right? Now there's something else, like power, right? I just got through a few weeks ago reading a biography of Mao, a new biography of Chairman Mao. A real monster, you know.
Yeah.
But he was so taken up with power, right? And it's kind of amazing, you know, his pursuit of power, huh? And when he was trying to get power, huh? He would not cooperate with the other communists for fear that they would have more control over things. He would sacrifice armies and so on just to make sure that the armies that remained were under his control. And larger armies, you know, of fellow communists, you know, were destroyed so that he could emerge superior. Mm-hmm. It's kind of amazing. But towards the end of his life, though, he was kind of losing power, and people were starting to, just ridiculous, the things he was doing. I mean, he was taking food from China and exporting it to get what? Technology and so on, and build up his war machine and so on. And he was actually killing millions who were starving because of this. Mm-hmm. And some of his, you know, close associates were revolting against this, right? Mm-hmm. And finally, at the end, he just couldn't control it anymore. They were going to stop this nonsense. Mm-hmm. And he was having this self-pity, you know, for his losing some power, you know, and associating in his mind anybody who felt from power, right? Invited Nixon, because Nixon, you know, lost power after the Watergate business. He had Nixon come back to see him, you know. But it was really about all these characters in history, you know, who had fallen from power and, you know, crying about Napoleon and so on. And I can help but think of it, you know, because, you know, likeness is the cause of love, right? You know, kind of, if you think it's redeeming in him, not that you can redeem him, really, but in the redeeming there, a little bit of his attachment to these other great men who have fallen and lost their power, you know, towards the end. And that's kind of funny. So, you know, they describe Khrushchev after he fell from power, you know, just moping around the house, you know, like a to live for, you know. And it's kind of frightening. So, it's interesting, you know, when Socrates argues that man is born knowing some things he didn't acquire in his life. It's kind of an exaggeration, a little bit of this. But, you know, since he takes as clear examples mathematical things, right? Mm-hmm. Like he'll take, for example, you know, where you get the idea of a flat surface. You say, well, the cake here is not flat, right? But this table is flat, okay? You say, well, I see the little dent here, you know, okay? So when you examine these so-called flat surfaces in the world around us, we see that they're not really flat. So how do we get the idea of what is really flat, truly flat, the flat itself, from something that is not really flat, right? See? And how can we make this judgment that this approaches much more to being flat than this does, right? But still falls short of it if we didn't have a knowledge of flatness not derived from what? These things around us. Mm-hmm. And he uses a very interesting comparison, huh? He says, if we brought in a painting or a statue of somebody, right? And you made the judgment.